Residents of the village of Deya all know the name Jacqueline Brown Waldron and that of her husband, Bill Waldron, the artist turned archaeologist whose many famous discoveries are almost the stuff of legend in Mallorca. Jackie arrived in Deya before electricity, spent 2 decades raising her children there, moved to Oxford to pursue a new career as an academic and teacher, and has now returned to Deya, where she is the matriarch of the expat community and has been adopted and embraced by the locals more than anyone before her. In this first interview for the Port of Sawyer radio programme, Jackie relates what brought her to Deya, what made her stay, and how she and Bill survived through the direst of financial straits by turning their hands to a variety of trades and disciplines. Hers is the most extraordinary and extraordinarily full life. Jackie Brown Waldron met Shirley Roberts on the terrace of the Café Saffront Fresca.
All the nice girls love a sailor. All the nice girls love a tar. For there's something about a sailor when you know what sailors are. Bright and breezy.
Now, what can I call her? I can call her the grandmother of Deya. I can call her the princess of Deya. I can call her Jackie Waldron, the very special lady of Deya. So welcome, Jackie.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Jackie has a story, a very big story that could occupy many programs, but take me back when you first waltzed into Deya, when you were just on your way through Europe, when you were about 18?
21. Well, I took a 1946 Dodge bus that left Palma at 3:30 every afternoon to come to this little village called Deya, which I didn't know very much about, except a friend in university had told me he'd been here for 6 months trying to write a book, and so if I was coming to Europe, I couldn't miss this particular place. So I came up on the bus into this quiet, little, magnificently ancient village and thought, what am I doing here? Sophisticated, recent university graduate, knows all the answers there are to know, 21 years old. And suddenly I was just lost in a natural wonder.
Where had you come from, Jackie? Where had you begun your journey to Mallorca?
I grew up in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. Went to Hollywood High School and UCLA. And had a rather normal middle class life. And my elder brother had come to Europe to study, and I said, well, when I graduate college, I'm going to come and see what's kept him there, because he came for a year and he'd been there for 3 years. So I saved my money and I did the, you know, do it on your own sort of, from place to place, took trains and planes and visited all the cities and got a taste of what Europe was like, and it was like I had a sign on me that said, unless you're tall, handsome, and extremely interesting, don't talk to me. So everybody talked to me because everybody was tall and handsome and extremely interesting.
Jackie, what can I ask you what year that was?
1959.
So you left LA on your own without a return ticket. So you headed for Europe, and Deya was your destination. You knew that.
Yeah, with $500 in my purse, and I was going to stay as long as possible, and I managed to stay for 5 months and get, well, actually I wasn't going to go back, because I met the man who became my husband here in Deya the first night I arrived. I mean, I didn't know at the time that he would be my husband, but you know, another one of these summer romances that actually led somewhere.
But in the 1950s, then, in Deya, I think you met him at Safonda, is that true?
Safonda was a small pension, an inn, and they had, I think, about 10 rooms. And it was $1 a day for 3 meals and your room. There was no running water and very limited electricity, a couple of hours in the morning, a couple of hours in the evening. I later found out that Robert Graves had paid for a generator to be put in one of the local shops so that there would be a few hours of electricity, both for him to work by and for the rest of the village to enjoy. But otherwise, candlelight was our way of enjoying the evenings. And at Safonda, we'd get up in the morning, have breakfast, walk down to the Kala, swim all day, all morning, walk back up at lunchtime, because it was all included, have lunch and a bottle of wine, and walk back down to the beach and watch the sun go down with the cognac, and then back up to the Fonda for dinner. Dinner was almost the same every night. 2 fried eggs and fresh green beans and 2 slices of melon. And you looked forward to that as though it was a culinary delight. There was something about it was predictable, while everything else around you was so overwhelmingly beautiful that you had to stop and breathe deeply to fully understand, or to stop yourself from sinking into it. So it was for this now much older woman to have experienced that, thinking I knew everything, I realized how little I knew.
What did you study? I mean, what did you just graduated with from your university? What was your ultimate plan?
Well, my first degree was in economics and psychology. My parents were in the fashion business, and I had wanted to go into fashion buying for big stores or design. But I hadn't really thought it through, but I knew I probably wanted to go to graduate school, but it was all very vague. The trip was just to open my mind a bit. And as time went on, life took over as my education for a while. And at age 42, I went with my husband to Oxford University and managed to do a master's degree and then a doctorate in anthropology, because my dream had always been, once I had started living here, to try to understand Deya, what's behind the myth of Deya, because just as you described me and I described Deya, it's not all these magical things. And, the book that I ended up writing about it was called Paradise and Reality, because paradise is something magical, but it's not real. And there's something going on all the time that makes it possible for there to be paradise. So that my education was experiential for 20 years before I went back to university.
Well, your family must have been horrified. There was their bright star, having gone through university and being sent off for this trip, and then you fall in love. I mean, for goodness sake, they must have been horrified.
Horrified. When I left America on this trip, my father said to me, I don't want you to go because it's going to be like your brother. You won't come back. Because my brother had ended up marrying a girl that he met, and, they didn't know when he'd be coming back. So, yeah, they were devastated. And when I met Bill, I thought it was just a summer romance. And then he kept bombarding me, the man had been married twice before and had a child. This was a hell of a situation for my parents to understand, But so I wrote them a letter, and they called long distance. Well, in those days, to make a long distance call was like a major effort and expense. And my mother got on the phone and she said, we're very happy to hear about you, but we'd like you to come home and talk about it and so on. And so then my father got on the phone. Well, my mother had always been the disciplinarian and the explainer and so on. My father was very sort of elegant and silent. He was a bit older than her. And he gets on and he starts saying, Jackie, darling, we've always wanted to give you the kind of wedding that you've dreamt up and so on. And I realized that he was reading, that they had written this all out before they made the call, so that no word would or moment would be wasted. And they tried to convince me to go back home. And Bill wasn't ready to come to America because he had a job on the American base in Paris. He was an artist at the time. And he said, let me talk to your mother. And he gets on the phone and he says, hi, Mom. Can you imagine? She was... Well, what could she say?
What swear word did she use? But I bet she didn't use any.
Well, she was very gallant, you know. Anyway, between them, and I realize now, I had nothing to do with the decision. They decided that I should go home for a month, prepare everything, and he would make all the arrangements for us to get married in Paris. So I did, and for 1 month, all my aunts and uncles and cousins tried to persuade me that this was the craziest thing that anybody could do. But I guess I had a strong sense of something that not many people would ever get a chance to enjoy. And the funny thing was, he'd been married, as I said, twice before, and had another relationship as well, and nothing had lasted more than 2 years. And I literally decided I would rather have 1 or 2 years with this man than to spend the rest of my life with anybody that I could ever imagine meeting anywhere else. And 45 years later, I still think I made the right decision.
That is a wonderful phrase. You would have chosen those 2 years even if it had not lasted any longer. Well, tell us all about Bill.
Well, when my father called this friend who had told me about Dea in the first place and said, Jackie's written and said she wants to marry this guy, do you know anything about him? And he said, no, I don't, but I'll ask a friend of mine who was also there longer. And then he called my dad and he said, she said she doesn't remember a lot, but she knows he was a bit of a snowman. And my father thought that meant drugs.
Yeah, cocaine, huh?
Yeah. Actually, what he meant was he was a storyteller. And Bill was a magical storyteller. And he started out, well, it was such a long story, you know. He was in the ski troops, and he was a professional ice skater with Sonia Henie and Holiday on Ice. And then he came to Europe, and he was an artist. He'd studied at the Art Students League, and he lived in Paris, and he painted and helped organize American Artists in Paris shows. And he was a sharer, you know. He had his enthusiasm for whatever he did was so great that he would always bring other people into it. So from the painting days, he came to Dea in the summers, and then he started bringing friends from Paris also. So there's probably 8 or 10 artists that are living or buried in Dea that came here with Bill, or, you know, Bill brought them. And then they formed painting exhibitions. And we bought a little ruin with the help of a couple of philanthropists that he met. And turned it into what we thought would be a cultural center. But then he started photographing caves and discovered this cave near Solier that had this prehistoric antelope gazelle in it, and that's a whole long, long story. Anyway, his life took a complete turnaround, and he gave up painting and became an archaeologist. He'd always read a lot of books on archaeology, and always wanted to be one, but had, you know, there's no money in archaeology, and so painting won out. Anyway, we worked at it. We got a small grant from a foundation in the States. He wrote letters about everything he found to the National Geographic, to the Smithsonian Institute. In the winters, it's so quiet here that you get... you know, you have lots of time. And he'd write letters to a paleontologist that might know something about this, who was at the Smithsonian. And then he'd cross off the days until he got his answer. You know, I mean, he was so intense on everything that he did. And in the meantime, he's telling stories and attracting people to come and volunteer with us. So the digs became a kind of, we'll give you room and board in exchange for digging with us, kind of like Workaway today, you know, 5 or 6 hours. But it was such a happy moment for everybody. You know, it was, they were all together and living together and working together, that it became a kind of thing that people were queuing up to do. It was fun.
Well, this is where Jackie Waldron, Earth Mother of Daya, has come into being, because there's a building just not very far from where we're sitting, looking over the mountains, which was her home, because she skipped the bit where she had a number of children of her own here, and her home became dormitories for all these young people that came to join the digs. And so, in fact, you were the centre of this place, the cultural centre. You brought everybody here, television crews. I mean, tell us all about your stuff when you were doing the digs and the... I mean, BBC television came and filmed your dig? Is that not correct?
We had Time Team. We were the first European project that Time Team ever did. But we started working with... there was a new department being set up in the Smithsonian Institution called the Study of Short-Lived Phenomena. And this was this fellow who went out to Mauritania to film the eclipse, and he took some of his friends with him, and they had such a good time that they thought, wouldn't this be a wonderful way for people who love doing scientific projects to join a scientist actually in the field work that they do. And so Bill applied to him, and we were the first project that a company at that time called Educational Expeditions International was developed. And then it changed to Earthwatch, which was in America for many years, but then also opened offices in Oxford, actually. And as fortune had it, we were 35 years with Earthwatch. We had, until Bill went to Oxford at age 50, so like from 1975 onward, we worked with Earthwatch, and we had, altogether 3,500 students, age 16 to 80, who came and worked with us on two-week excursions. And they worked. And I've written a couple of articles, one called Digging Daya. And it's really funny how they had a reason for being in Daya that wasn't just the beach or sex or sand, but all of that fit into it. There was time for everything.
alongside this, you brought up your girls, and you have the most wonderful family. Most of them still live here. Tell us about your girls.
Well, I started having daughters soon after getting married. Tally was my first, and she was born here in Mallorca. The night before she was born, I didn't know how we were going to pay for the hospital, and I sort of panicked. Maybe it was a week before she was born. And because Bill was still painting at that period. And I said to him, I think I have to go back to the States, because I always remembered a story my mother told when my brother was born in 1936, that when they checked into the hospital, they wanted immediately a cash deposit. And this was in Los Angeles in 1936. And I thought, oh my God, if they ask for that here, what are we going to do? Because we were living on about $25 a month. And so he said, just trust me. And I literally went to sleep crying that first sort of words we'd had in the many, many months, almost a year we were married. And the next morning, we were living in an apartment over the central telephone. And there was a phone call. They called him from downstairs and said, there's a call for you, Bill. And he went downstairs. Now, in July, he had had an art exhibition in Madrid in a very fine, the Biosca Gallery, which was very well known. But nothing had been sold. But it was a great adventure, and we knew at least his name would get known and so on. And he came up from that telephone call, and he said, what's the last thing I said to you before you went to sleep last night? And I said, trust you. And he said, well, they just sold 7 of my 11 paintings. And I guess maybe that's the story of our life. You know, it was never, it was always a struggle. It was always, oh my God, you can't buy another computer. You can't buy the first computer because we can't afford it. Trust me, trust me. And everything he set his mind on, we managed to do together, of course. And I realized, talking with some other people not long ago, that I thrive on challenges. If there, even if I'm asked to write something, I'm sure you know this yourself, if it's due on Friday, I'm going to get it done. If it's due in a month's time, I'll get it done a week before it's due. And I don't know what it is. I think it's the excitement, the adrenaline that gives you that oomph to, you know, get on with something. But it's... challenges are, and to have this child in a country where I spoke Spanish, but I remember going to the Mary Nostrum clinic, it was at the time. I said I wanted to at least go to a clinic. I didn't want a midwife because I thought in case anything goes wrong. And going through the hallways on the delivery cart and saying, un momento, por favor, tengo un contracción. That means a minute, please. I'm And when I think about it, after, I mean, it's hysterical, you know, the crazy things that you do without even thinking. And I knew nothing about babies. I don't think I'd ever held a baby, you know. I was 22 years old. They handed her to him immediately, which was quite, he was in the room for the birth. And that, too, was very special in those days, you know. And then my folks said, you have to come back to the States so we can meet Bill and your daughter. And my grandmother died and left us some money. So we went to L.A., and I was hardly there and discovered I was pregnant again. So 18 months since the first Dia was born. Now, we named her after the village, but I didn't, at the time, the village was spelled in the Castilian way, D-E-Y-A. And I didn't want that to be her name, but I wanted it to be similar. So I said, oh, I'll change the Y to an I. So it's D-E-I-A. Little did I know that that was the original Catalan spelling eons ago. So many people call her Dea. I call her Dia. But since her, many people have given that name to their daughters, to the point that Richard Branson's granddaughter was the title on the Spanish papers, Dia un nom propi, which means Dia is now a proper first name. And my daughter Dia called the newspaper and said, Dia es un nom propi desde 1961. Yeah. Me!
You were so ahead of your time. You were so ahead of your time.
It's so funny. Yeah. Soon after we came back here, Tana was on her way. So there I was with three little girls, hardly any income. Bill was still painting. Yeah. And we thought, you know what, in Dare we're not going to make it. He did some architectural work with Robert Graves and some other places. And we said, let's try Palma. So we went into Palma, and the first night we were there, we were contacted by a couple of English developers who were going to open a Carnaby Street type boutique for the first time in Mallorca. This was 1965. So we'd been a good 5 years in and out in Dea. So we went to Palma, we'd settled in Palma, and we both had jobs the first night we were there. I was asked to work with the designer of, because she didn't speak any Spanish, and I was her translator, and we went to Barcelona to get the fabric. So there I was, back in my fashion dream, without an effort, you know. And this is, again, everything came to us because we knew what we wanted, but we never set out to just get that. We just kept doing the things we knew how to do and trying to survive, you know. So that was a great opportunity for me to learn about the fashion business in Spain and to help her. And Bill was asked to design the boutique. It was called Etc. Of course, it was called Etc. The Newman brothers. One of them is still on the island. And then Mike Jeffries from the Electric Eye Recording Company came over. He had the Animals and Jimi Hendrix and other such things. And Bill and he decided they should open an art gallery. So over at Cetra, next door, there was this beautiful art gallery. So there we were doing the things we love to do, and then coming on the weekends to Daya to kind of breathe the fresh air and so on. And the digging had started then, but we had to leave it aside. It got more active, and the digging took over when he found the cave of Muleta with this prehistoric antelope gazelle. So it was an interesting time. We were 7 years in Palma. The Et Cetera was a huge success, but the owner fell in love with lobster and champagne every night, so he went through the funds in many ways that were not part of the program. So a friend came to us and said, well, why don't you open your own boutique? And by that time, Bill was making silver jewelry as well for Et Cetera, but he hadn't presented the line yet. So this friend said, well, why don't you open your own boutique with the jewelry? So we opened a little hole in the wall called Vision X, and it was next door to, across from El Barco. We were all in near Plaza Gomila, which was the swinging place of Palma. And we had Vision X for 7 years, and it kept us going while we started the digs and while we got the funding from the foundations, and we decided to sell it and take a chance on living in Daya all the time. And that was in 73. In the meantime, somebody had offered us a piece of land next to the museum for people to park cars for like $250 or something. And we'd go there in the evening and we'd sit and Bill would start to draw, and it's, you know, how everything is terraced here. And he drew this beautiful potential house, and I said, oh, that's a real pipe dream. And he became very friendly with a lot of the local builders. They were all guys, all worked with their hands, and they loved his humor and his energy, and he enjoyed them a lot too. And they said, Bill, if you want to build a house, you do it now, because the prices are rising every day. You can't pay straight away, pay what you can while you can. I mean, it was so incredible those days. You'd shop at the village shop and you'd get the bill once a month or once a year, more likely once a year on St. Michael's Day. But the trust was unbelievable. Because you trusted, it was a reciprocal arrangement. And they did take care of us a lot. I mean, I didn't know how to bring up children. I had the people downstairs who would bring me lentils and beer and say, this is good for you, the milk for the baby. And she's crying, we'll take her downstairs for an hour. You get your sleep and eat a nice meal and then come down and get her. I mean, it was just a heavenly time and place to have children.
But you had no money, Jackie. You must have been worried out of your life.
Absolutely. I was very worried. He said, the builder said, don't worry. And so he lived up here while I had the boutique in Palma. And then I would come up on the weekends and bring enough money or food to cook for whoever. We got the local friends, the artists and writers, to pitch in a couple of hours a day in exchange for lunch. So I'd make macaroni. We'd outside where we were building, you know. It was.
But you had no oven.
No.
You
had a gas burner in the early days. No, you didn't even have gas. Well, you had a charcoal burner when I first got married. And we got one of the first little blue bottles of butane gas. Oh, no, I was cooking down the road because we didn't have the big house yet. We were building that. We built that 73, 74. Took 9 months, like all our other creations.
Babies' houses.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had a lot of fun, yeah. If we got anything coming in, Bill would pass it to them, and they'd say, are you sure it's okay? And sometimes their wives would bring us big pots of food, you know. But I had the boutique then, so we could live off of the boutique. That was very, I was very ingenious. I had very little stock other than the jewelry, but I had lots of Vogue magazines, and if somebody came in and they didn't see a few things on the rack that I had taken from other designers, I would say, did you have something particular in mind? And they say, well, I have to go to a cocktail party and so on. So I said, well, you know, this Nehru style outfit would look great on you. Here's the fabrics I could make it in. And they choose the fabric they like, and I take their measurements and a deposit, and I'd run out and buy the material and take it to the dressmaker with my drawing with their measurements and pray that the next day they'd have it basted together so I could do a fitting. And many well-dressed women in Torino still are wearing some of the Nehru suits that I made way back in the early 70s. And then I came up here, and when we built the house, and we had a little boutique where you now see there's a vintage shop, but there was a wine bar before that, and before that it was dormitories. And I opened a little boutique there, and at the time, there was a number of excellent artists in Palmas. Well, one of them was Ellis Jacobson, lovely artist. And he had connections with the Chicago Museum of Modern Art. And a woman who had lived here on the island with her kids for a couple of years was organizing a tour for the Chicago Museum, an art tour of Europe, of Spain. And so she got in touch with Ellis and asked him, you know, who they should visit, and he would set it all up. And he rang and asked if they could come and visit Bill, and I said, sure. And he said, and they'd like you to recommend a good restaurant in Dea. And I said, well, let me check on that. And then I thought, well, I had just done my first Earthwatch group, so I had catered for 20 people every day. And I said, how many do you expect? And he said, oh, I guess 10 or 15. So I said, do you know what, Alice? I said, I could cater it at $10 a head. I mean, that was a lot of money in those days. But to America, it was nothing. And I laid out this menu, a whole ham, chickens, turkeys, coleslaw, you know, potato salad, tumbet, a few Mallorquin dishes. I had to borrow the fridges of my neighbors so that I could pre-prepare some of these things and put them up. And then I realized that I had started making my first collection of peasant wear for the boutique that I was setting up. And I thought, I'll bring them in to Dea, and I'll have them all on show for these people. Well, in that one day, I catered, there were 25 people or more. I sold everything. My girls I sent down to the boutique, who were like 13 and 14 at the time, they sold every dress and blouse that I had made and jewelry. I said to Bill, all we have to do is this once a month, and we don't have to do anything else. You know, we had enough for the summer to live.
But I mean, I can see. I never met your parents, but I can just imagine what they were saying back at the ranch. There was this wonderful, comfortable middle class life waiting for you in LA, and you were here. And you didn't know each day whether you had enough money to feed your family. That's tough. That's hard life.
In Mallorca, it was. You had credit, which was the important thing. And also, my dear dad passed away, and my mom came over to live in 1967. So my fourth daughter was born the month that I was planning to open the boutique. So my mom arrived a week early, and I could wheel the baby to her little flat on Calle Salud and go down and open my boutique. So
she lived on the Torino then?
She lived in Torino. Yeah. And the first thing she did was to take a Spanish class, and so she met all these other Americans and had a whole friendship group going. And she adapted. She was fantastic. And then she met a charming Englishman, and so she said she was married 60 years to two different men, 33 to my father and 26 or 7 to her new partner.
Wow.
So, and it was wonderful for us. He died at 93 and she died at 96. And we never had anything but great joy from both of them, you know. It was
That's
really
fantastic.
Nice, yeah.
Tell me the story of when Desmond Morris came knocking.
That was Well, that was another one of those situations, you know, where I said to Bill, you know, as long as we're here and we've got this beautiful house, because the house that he built was absolutely amazing. It's all sculpted fireplace. There's a natural rock. There's all the doors and windows are made of mahogany that we bought on the island and carved. There's raven's heads and Northwest American Indian carvings all over the doors and inside, and his sculptures, your olive wood sculptures. So it's quite amazing. And one day we were in the house and there was a knock on the door, and there was this rather distinguished looking Englishman and his blonde wife and their young son. And he had a book in his hand, and it was Iberian Prehistory by Luis Pericote Garcia, who was a very famous archaeologist from Barcelona. And he had it open to a particular page where there was a large pot with incisions on it. And he said, I wondered if the man that found this pot lives here, because I'm interested in talking to him. And he said, it says Waldron. I said, yes. I said, this is the place. I said, do come in. I'll get him. He was up in his, he had an office on the roof. And I asked his name. And I went upstairs and I said, Bill, there's some people who would like to meet you. And he came down, and he introduced himself, and his wife and I sat at this end of the table, and they were at that end of the table, the two of them talking. And while I was talking to the wife, it suddenly, like a bell ran off in my house. I think he said his name was Desmond Morris, and I said to the wife, African Genesis. And she said, no, it's close, it's a naked ape. And I realized that we had Desmond Morris in our and he and Bill hit it off like a house hopping. They were born, Bill was born February 5th, Desmond's born February 6th. They were both scientists, but previously surrealist painters, because Desmond has quite a large period of wonderful surrealistic painting. They were both storytellers. They were both amazing personalities. You know, they just, it was just great. And a year later, when we went, Bill was invited to give a talk at the British Museum, we arranged to go and see a student who was at Oxford that year, and he had the degrees manual open, showing that Oxford has welcomes people who have made success in their field but never actually done advanced degrees, and that he said, Bill, you can apply for this. Bill was 50 years old. And he applied, and he got accepted at Oxford University to do a PhD in Balearic prehistory. And the first week we were in Oxford, when we were students, and that's a whole other story, Desmond Morris had a big party for us to introduce us to all the cognoscenti in the science world. And but before that, when Bill got accepted, I wasn't about to let him go off by himself to Oxford without his family. So I went up to look for a job, and I saw in the newspaper that the smallest apartment, but that would accommodate six of us, was about £280 a month, which was pretty cheap when you think about it today, but... But the highest paying job was like £180 a month for the sort of thing that I thought I could do, you know, a bit of research, or I think, yeah, I applied all sorts of things. Then I saw this little ad, and it said girls' residence halls for A-level college and English as a foreign language, called St. Clair's Hall. I didn't know what it was. I went to see it. I applied for the job, and it turns out they had 11 Victorian houses, and they had what they called a warden with a child or a partner living in the house and overseeing the 18 or 20 students. Well, to make a long story short, I made an appointment, and it was on the last day of the week that I was in Oxford. I spent the rest of the time sightseeing, because I thought, if I don't get this job, I can't go. So when I went to the interview for the job, the secretary said that the director, who was this lovely woman, Anne Dreidel, who had been crippled in the war, had a headache, but that she would be there an hour later than my appointment if I could come back. So I walked out the door, and up on the corner I saw a sign that said schools, So I went across the street and I went to the high school and to the middle school and asked to see the principal and said, if I live in this area, can my children go to your school? They've been going to Spanish schools. They're completely bilingual verbally, but they don't read and write much English. Oh, we'll get them going very quickly. No problem. They're more than welcome. By the time I went back to get the interview, Anne and I got on like a house of fire. She said, the only thing that I'm concerned about is, she said, I do have to check your reference. And I had put Desmond Morris down as a reference. And you have to look at the accommodation because it's quite limited. So I went to look, and there was this small little living room and then a bedroom with bunk beds in it, and then a little tiny galley kitchen, and off the kitchen was a larder. And I thought, well, one of the girls can sleep. The larder won't be used as a larder. It'll be a small bedroom. And then the other two can be here. And the oldest one wanted to stay here just to finish whatever it was at 16 she had to do. And so I said that would be okay. I went back and told her. And the next morning, first Desmond called, and he said, well, I was called for a reference for you, and I raved about you, and so on. Mind you, do you see, I had spent that summer with Earthwatch, so I had catered for six groups of people, and I thought, oh, I can do this sort of thing. But I did get the job, and they gave me an additional bedroom. So we had three bedrooms and a sitting room. Bill and I slept in a sitting room. They gave us our own bathroom, which we wouldn't have to share. And they said we could use the common room with the girls, which was huge, to watch television and that sort of thing. And £8 a week. And free board. So we stay there, £8 a week, and then all our meals we could have in the dining room, which was next door. Or if we didn't want to eat there, which of course my kids, you know, they didn't adapt to English food very well, I could buy with my meal tickets a whole ham, whole chicken, all kinds of fresh veg and so on. So I came back here and I said, Bill, you know the story about the guy who is wearing a white suit and falls into a pile of you-know-what and comes out cleaner than he fell in? Well, that's us. And again, we had 7 years at St. Clair's. Bill was asked to teach photography. I was asked to teach domestic science. He worked on his thesis. And the kids were able to go to school there. And then they were able to come to St. Clair's for very little because I was on the staff. And it was, again, and then I got into women's studies, and they said, you know, you should do an advanced degree, and it just went on from there, and that's a whole other story.
This is a whole other story, and what's coming through is, I've got to ask you, whether, is it God, is it fate, is it love, is it the universe, what's controlled everything to work out so beautifully, or is it just your attitude, your mental attitude to the whole lot?
Well, I'd like to say that it's all those wonderful things that most people believe in. But I think it's tenacity and one's inner spirit that says, this isn't going to get me down. And Bill was the same way, and we tried to impart this in our children, and I see that it works because they're all very innovative and not afraid to try new and different things. The oldest one is in real estate. She was the first realtor in Daya. Nobody ever thought of having a realtor. And the Meyer Keynes trust her because she's one of them, you know. It's just sticking to your guns. And whenever things look like they're down, turning them to up, you know, even if it's the measliest job. I mean, and in Daya, there was no sort of value judgment on what you did, you know. So, like, if the kids got jobs washing dishes when they were 14, they also learned how the best restaurants were cooking. And they did all these, they had pocket money all the time through their own efforts. If they wanted a bike, they had to earn half of it, and we'd find a way to get the other half. The hardest part, I think, were those years when we were in Palma and they went to the Immaculada and they needed uniforms. And our third daughter, Tana, was very tall, sprang up every year much more than the others. So I made her skirt, I made all their uniforms with a hem that was about 12 inches, I think. It was almost a double skirt. And I had to lower it 3 or 4 inches every year, and there was a mark where it was. And she always reminds me, you don't know how difficult it was for me going to school. With, you know, every time you lowered the hem on my dress, there was a stripe.
The hem, oh dear, that really...
Kids experience things so uniquely. And, for instance, growing up with all these students in the house when we ran the dig, one of the girls says she always felt that they were the last ones we listened to because we were having to listen to these people that were there for such a short period. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that. And the other three say, on the contrary, we learned how to deal with people. Now we can deal with all people from all over the world. We're not afraid of new adventures, etc., etc. So each human being has their own unique way of responding to things, and some are extremely sensitive, and it's hard when you're on a fast pace like we were to realize this until later. And then, so if you have a sensitive gift, give your all at the moments that they want your attention, because then they gain their confidence and then they don't need it. But if they don't get it, it stays with them a long time. You know?
Jackie, it was not so long ago that you received, I think you've received a number of honours in your life because you're a modest flower that many, many people respect. But there was a moment not very long ago where you had the greatest honour and you were invited to Parma to give the address. Tell us about the Pregón, because it's very, very important. And you were the first
foreigner to do it.
Yeah.
I retired today, in 2013-14, because I'd been at Oxford all this time, and because I was freelance in Oxford, I was teaching and doing research. They didn't care how old I was getting, as long as I was still enthusing the students, which I hope I did. So when I came back here, the first winter in Dea, I thought, this is just, you know, I'm used to a much more stimulating intellectual and social atmosphere. I need libraries, and I need concerts, and I need, you know, people who are also working like I am. So one of my daughters said, let's get a flat in Palma and see if, you know, rent a flat and spend a couple of days there and see what it's like. And so I spent the next, well, a friend, I wrote to my daughter in L.A. to tell her, and she has a friend who lives most of the time in Mexico but has a flat in Santa Catalina in Palma, and he said it was empty, and if I wanted it, he would let me stay there for next to nothing. It was a fourth-floor walk-up, so it was a combination of exercise and perfect location, and I fell in love with the whole ambiance of Santa Catalina. And it's so funny because when I think how we rejected Tirreno, you know, and came back to Dea, and now I'm back in Santa Catalina, which is very close to Tirreno, and hoping one day that Tirreno will get gentrified as Santa Catalina has. Anyway, then I started going to conferences and gallery openings and talks in different places. And I met some lovely people at a conference on tourism. I met the Minister of Tourism and the head of the parliament and so on and so forth. And I don't know quite how it came about, but about a couple of weeks later, I get this call from a friend of mine who grew up in Dea and was a journalist for the parliament. And he said, they'd like you to consider giving the Pregón in December. Well, the Pregón of Palma is commemorating the discovery of Palma, or the conquest of the Moors in Palma in 1229 by Jaime I, as we call him, James I, as I've heard British refer to him. And it's a way of telling the story historically and any other way that people would like to do. I knew nothing about it. I'd never been in Palma for that celebration. But this very lovely archivist of Palma, Tumi Bestard, who turned out to be the son of Toomey Bestard, who had been the American consul representative in the 60s through the 80s when we first came here, and actually had come up when they made my husband an adoptive son of Dea. He had come up to the unveiling of the monument put up for him. Toomey is the archivist of Palma and absolutely magnificent source of brilliant information about anything to do with ancient Palma. So he told me, showed me some of the earlier pregones, gave me copies, gave me a couple of... I knew a lot about the history because I had studied it for the book that I wrote about insiders and outsiders in Mallorca, in Dea, really. So he said, I think what they'd like is a combination of your personal experience and the history, relating the history. So I had a lot of fun. I was back into full-time research and spending my days in the libraries and in the books and in my own book to remind me of, you know, various things that I've written. And I wrote this speech, but to do it properly, it had to be in at least Spanish, if not in Catalan. And I speak Catalan in my own understandable manner with as many gestures as words, but I would never be able to write properly in it. So there was a young woman who grew up with my kids, Nicole Domonville, and I knew she was a professional translator and would be sensitive to what I was talking about. And I asked her if she could translate it, and she said she'd be delighted. And she translated it into Catalan. And I was honored by the mayor and taken up to the podium and the meeting hall in the city hall of Palma and stood in front of this vast audience and gave my little talk. And the funniest thing was that I talked about Torino and about having my boutique and how Torino was the place where all the young Spanish fellows came to check out the Scandinavian and English girls who were coming to the island because their girls had to be in at 9 o'clock at night. And the night before the lecture, I had dinner with a lovely Mallorcan friend, and he said, "Oh, those are the picadores de playa." And I said, "Oh, I know that." He said, "Call them that, you know." And so when I said, and in Plaza Gomila, there are all these picadores de playa, well, the audience laughed. And they had published this little book of the speech. And when the speech was over, people began to queue up with these books for me to sign, wow, to autograph them. I was dumbfounded. And these old men with gray beards came up and said, "I was one of the picadores."
That's a fantastic story.
I think you should end there.
I think actually, we'll end there for this time, but there's so much, so much. I mean, I really want to talk to you about the book, the Inside and Outsiders book. And then we've got
a new book.
You have a new book. We're going to have to make another time, another appointment, but the pleasure has been ours. Thank you so much, Jackie.
You're a great interviewer. You ask provocative questions. It was great fun. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bright and breezy. Ship ahoy!